Marker was so important to me that I'm happy to tip my hat to him many times. And I've been, you know, working on a series of shorts that are somewhat in homage to him. Maybe they'll even fall together in a longer form thing. I don't know. But, you know, here's to Chris Marker, wherever he may roam.
This is Adam Chartoff, and you're listening to FilmWax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films. Hi, everyone. It's Adam Chartoff, the host of FilmWax Radio, the independent film talk show. You're listening to episode number 210. That was Jem Cohen, who is my guest today, talking about someone who has played a very inspirational role in his life, Chris Marker. And we're going to get to that conversation in a little bit. This episode is sponsored by Fandor. Have you gone to Fandor.com? If you have an access to an internet connection, pause me right now. Go check out Fandor.com and then come back in a few. Just you can explore it a little bit. If you love independent film, if you love going to the film festivals, whether it locally or otherwise, this is your site, because you're going to get that kind of experience, but on an internet connection. If you have Roku at home, you can just watch it right on your TV. I can't make an announcement for them, but I can say that if you don't have Roku, you'll probably still be able to get it on your TV at some point soon, because they're blowing up. Fandor is growing all the time. As a matter of fact, I put together a small list of recent things I've seen that are on Fandor, and then we'll get into today's show. One is a film I saw called Caesar Must Die by those seasoned art filmmakers, the brothers Taviani. If you haven't seen Caesar Must Die, it's actually shot in a prison in Rome with actual prisoners who are performing a production of Julius Caesar. So what you're watching is about the process of the creation of this performance. I can't really explain it any better, but you have to see it, because it's one of those these hybrid films which, you know, you'd think would be coming from some young, hip filmmaker. Not to say the Taviani brothers aren't hip. I mean, I think they're probably in their 70s. They're hip, of course, just because they're still around making relevant cinema. So this one actually had its U.S. premiere at the New York Film Festival. I think it was 2012. But, boy, is it a unique film. And you can see it now on Fandor. What else did I see recently? Another one that I recommend is My Best Fiend. Fandor recently have put up and has gotten sole streaming rights for the Werner Herzog catalog. And so everybody has a favorite. One of my personal favorites is My Best Fiend, which Werner Herzog made as an homage to his relationship, the very volatile relationship that he had with his starring actor, Klaus Kinski, who I believe was in probably around half a dozen Herzog films, but most importantly because he was in Aguirre, The Wrath of God, Fritz Giraldo, a number of others that are considered, I suppose, Herzog's period in the 70s when Herzog was at his height of creative energy. And not only was the relationship, just his whole approach to cinema was like throwing himself into it, going to all manners of the corners of the globe and shooting films in the most ungodly places. And then his relationship, of course, with Klaus Kinski is just crazy. It's bizarre. And this documentary, My Best Fiend, is a look back at their relationship. It's phenomenal. You have to see it. Anyway, go watch that, My Best Fiend. Another one which I want to point out that I really love, All the Light in the Sky. Joe Swanberg made this last year. It came out right after Drinking Buddies, though I think he made it prior to that. And it stars Jane Addams and Sophia Tikal, who were on my podcast talking about this very film only a couple months back. And but it's a delightful film. It's just a really small, sophisticated film, and I highly recommend it. It's called All the Light in the Sky. Joe will be back on the podcast later this month to talk about that film and his other three films that he has on Fandor. In the meantime, also Audrey the Trainwreck, which was made by Frank V. Ross. He was on this podcast with his most recent film, but this goes back a few films for him. Audrey the Trainwreck, it's great. Another early guest of mine that's been on the podcast a couple times, his name is Adam Reed. He made a film called Hello Lonesome. That's on there. And one other I'm going to squeeze in, and then we'll get right to it, is a documentary about Harry Nilsson. It's called Who is Harry Nilsson and Why is Everybody Talking About Him? And it's directed by John Scheinfeld. And it's a terrific music doc, and it really gets to the heart of Harry Nilsson and his memory, justice, and his music, his legacy, and almost as importantly, his singing. Harry Nilsson had a voice that was so rare to pop music. And what's lovely about John Scheinfeld's documentary, it really gets into the heart of it, and you really feel like, even if you're not a huge Harry Nilsson fan, you're going to probably afterwards want to get all the music. It's one of those docs. So those are just a handful of Fandor films that I recommend, and you know, we'll bring more of them soon. Okay, episode 210. Jem Cohen is the guest. Jem Cohen is a, well, he's a filmmaker, he's a photographer, he's an artist, he works in several mediums. He's a kind of serious guy. I mean, I'm not to say he can't, you know, let his hair down, but, you know, when he talks about his career, when he talks about art making, he gets kind of intense. I mean, it was great. I loved it. I thought I would go in there, talk to him for 20, 30 minutes and get out of there, but we talked for an hour and 15 minutes, I think. Not all of it's in the final edit, but most of it is. Anyway, he has a couple of films on Fandor, including his most recent film, a narrative feature called Museum Hours, is on there, as well as a documentary he made some years ago called Instrument, about the band Fugazi. So he's a an enormous admirer of Chris Marker, who is a documentary filmmaker from France, who died a few years back at the age of 91. He has left an indelible mark on filmmaking. He made a film called Le Jeté, which was a science fiction short film using still photographs, except for one small exception. And it later was remade into a feature film called 12 Monkeys. But it's a remarkable film. And it has also, it is considered a classic. He also made a film called Sans Soleil, which unfortunately you cannot see on Fandor, but you can see it elsewhere. It's on the Criterion Collection, FYI. But there are quite a few Chris Marker films that are on Fandor, for one thing, but also, as it so happens, there is going to be a Chris Marker retrospective on the Sundance Now Doc Club website. So I'm going to talk to Jem because Jem is such a fan, but also because they've included his film, Museum Hours, in this retrospective. So it was a natural thing that I would talk to Jem, someone who already was on the list of people I wanted to talk to. So it was my pleasure to talk to Jem about his career and also about the career of Chris Marker. Ebert Country.
Yeah.
Well, so supposedly I kind of combined, I don't know if you picked up on this, but I combined two different things, components that are happening at the moment. And one was this Chris Marker retrospective on the Sundance Now Doc Club series, and which Museum Hours is included. And then also the fact that a couple of your films are now on Fandor's website.
Mm-hmm.
So with these two things happening and converging, this was the opportunity to sit down and talk. Not that I need it. You were always on my mind anyway, so I'm not going to break into song. But
like a Willie fan.
That's right. Okay, so let's go back a little bit for my own benefit, if you don't mind, I was just curious where you grew up.
I grew up in Washington, D.C., primarily. I moved around a lot when I was a kid. I was born in Afghanistan because my father was working for USAID and Columbia University. And then I lived a couple of years in Brazil when I was 4 and 5, but mostly I grew up in the D.C. area.
Yeah. You see, you probably don't have any memories of the Afghanistan section, though it makes for an interesting origin.
It's probably somewhere in my subconscious color palette, but I can't say that I remember it.
Yeah. That's an interesting thought, though, that it's part of your identity in some manner, even though you may not be able to tap into it memory-wise.
Yeah.
But it's there, isn't it?
Well, it's there, and it's also, it's an odd thing because Afghanistan was sort of complete, everyone was completely oblivious to it here for first 35 years or so of my life, and then suddenly everybody knew all too well, you know, what Afghanistan was for all the wrong reasons. So it's it has taken on a political complexity that's deeply tragic, and you know, it's on my passport, so it probably
Do you feel somewhat defensive for Afghanistan at the time? You know,
defensive for any country that gets steamrolled by criminal political intention. I mean, you know, Afghanistan had also been steamrolled by the Soviet Union, but it was completely repulsive to know that my own government was using Afghanistan as a kind of
smokescreen of sorts.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Have you been back?
No, I've never been there, and I don't know that would be viable.
Or the wisest decision.
But I would love
moment,
to have, have seen it in my adult life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then you said for a while were in Brazil?
Just for a couple of years when I was 4 years old. Uh-huh. But, you know, my family traveled a lot, and I think that's a big part of who I am. I travel a lot when I can.
Your dad was a bureaucrat? That's such a negative word.
No, he was in education. My dad was helping to set up schools.
Oh, very good.
And then became an editor of a journal of early childhood education, and my mom wrote children's books. So, and they were both very interested in the arts. My dad painted, and we were taken to museums all around the world.
Mm-hmm. You ended up a filmmaker and a photographer, artist. Was it sort of all naturally sort of this curiosity to experiment in different mediums in order, you know, just as a natural thing, but maybe never settled into one proper, like, you consider yourself an artist, I suppose, as opposed to a filmmaker?
Well, I've usually referred to myself as a filmmaker just because somehow it sounds a little less pretentious than to say I am an artist, but I don't really distinguish between media and formats, and those photography and film are both kind of two sides of the photographic coin.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all stuff that I like to do, and some of it is dictated by necessity. You know, it's a lot cheaper to take a still than make a movie. But
You can
I love it all, yeah.
I'm sorry to interrupt. But you can reach a lot of people through film, too, which is a nice benefit of that, right? But I was going to get back to growing up in Washington. And then I was wondering where the fascination or the urge to become a filmmaker was, but it's a little bit different with your case because maybe you were experimenting in other disciplines first.
Well, I wasn't so much, but all of my friends were. My friends in D.C. when I was in high school, many of my closest friends became musicians in the punk rock moment that hit D.C. pretty hard, and that was a tremendous influence on me, but I just wasn't musically inclined. So I was taking some of my earliest stills at the time, but even so, I hadn't set out to to document the scene or anything. I was really mostly going to shows because I wanted to be there and hear the music. But I, you know, it was a template. It was an extraordinary education in what is now often called DIY. So that ended up playing a big part just in terms of it being an example of creating things outside of an industry which had no interest in you and in which, you know, the music industry for them, eventually the film industry for me, had little to do with what we were actually interested in.
You ended up in going to that hotbed of conservative thinking and Wesleyan University.
Well, when I went to Wesleyan, there was a film department that had an extraordinary focus on more or less classical Hollywood cinema and some very good teaching along those lines, but there was virtually no documentary and certainly no experimental film. You know, I took a class in sort of on the periphery of the, there wasn't even a film department when I was there. I mean, there was a film technical department, but there was no film major. Let me correct that.
Right.
So I took a class in German cinema. That was interesting. And I got a very in-depth look at Hitchcock and Westerns and folks like Otto Preminger, but I also worked at the film series there, which was quite intensive, and that was a bit of a real revelation. Mm-hmm. We booked films like Jean Vigo films that became much more influential for me than the Hollywood stuff.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty amazing, because how would you have, I guess you discovered these types of filmmakers in college, right? Because, I mean, how would you have had the exposure up to that point? I guess you were talking about the early to mid-80s now, right?
Yeah. So this was pre-internet, and right. I had not had much exposure.
Even like
almost nine,
renting a VHS
really.
Was about 10 years old at that point. And,
yeah, nobody I knew did that in college. I mean, nobody had a VHS in their own dorm.
So,
I learned a lot by reading about things in the art library and coming across references to films and stills from them. But it was really, and in art history, we saw things like Michel Andalou, but it wasn't until a good deal later on that I really became aware of the tradition that I'm now more part of or comfortable with. Mm. But I also, I mean, it was a thrill. It was a time when there were, I think, four major Hitchcock films that were entirely unavailable on that. And they screened them in 35 millimeter.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think I saw Vertigo in 35 when Vertigo was entirely unavailable. And then it's interesting that's such a pivotal film for Chris Marker and other people. And so
thanks for reminding me about that.
Yeah. I mean, so I don't,
that's very true.
I never really, you know, bought the kind of strict dichotomy between experimental film and narrative film or Hollywood film. I think that there's a lot of blurred boundaries there. But it is quite true that I wasn't, the focus was not on blurred boundaries in my education. And then that became kind of my own interest and
right,
discovery
over time.
And
yeah.
obsession.
So hence you're ultimately, I guess you're being put in this category of being influenced by Chris Marker. You're writing that kind of tension also between, or as you put it, the blurry area between conventional narrative storytelling and what we call everything else, which is experimental.
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't think I saw any Marker while I was in college. I may have seen La Jetée. I certainly didn't see Saint-Soleil until many years later. I left school to make my own first film. I worked for a small company, a husband and wife that made industrials in Florida about childbirth and firefighting, and I had known them.
Not in the same movie, ostensibly, right? We're talking about
separate sides of the family business, but it was they were very self-sufficient and very very good at working small, and I worked for them as a shipping clerk so that I could use their gear on my off hours, and they had a Beaulieu R16, which also, interestingly, is the camera that Marker shot Saint-Soleil with. So,
wow.
But at the time, I was cobbling together making a film on my own because I didn't know anybody. I didn't have a crew. I was in Florida working as a shipping clerk, and I had to make a thesis film out of what was at hand. And so my first film is a experimental narrative hybrid, and it wasn't, I think if I was influenced by anything, it certainly may have been Jean Vigo. But really it was practical discovery by just stumbling into what I could do, you know, and what somehow interested me. It didn't occur to me to have a template for it. It just felt natural.
Mm-hmm. Well, I could see around this time. Did you take off any time before school, or did you go? Because I'm kind of guess that you graduated around 84, 85.
I graduated 84.
84,
yeah.
Okay. So then you went down to Florida because this job opportunity, or did you go down? You were traveling a little bit, and
well, they didn't have much filmmaking at Wesleyan at all, and I wanted to make films, you know, and so.
And you weren't in Washington anymore. Now you were kind of free to be wherever
you
were.
My family had moved to the Boston area by the time I finished college, but basically, there was very little production at Wesleyan. There was very little in the way of gear, and it just wasn't an environment that was that conducive to making odd movies. Mm. And so I also was running out of money, and my financial aid was in peril. So I took off and did a working semester and made my thesis and graduated early in essence.
This was undergraduate.
This was undergraduate. I never went to grad school. I never went to film school.
Okay. It's interesting. I think it was in 84 where they re-released. Finally, they were able to theatrically release Vertigo.
That could well be.
Because I was living in Boston, and I remember going to the Brattle, and they were playing The Trouble with Harry. Is it The Trouble with Harry? Or, you know, he's the one where...
Yeah.
He's a corpse.
I don't remember which the ones.
But it was Vertigo was one of them.
Yeah.
And I believe Rear Window was another one. And they had been in some legal morass where you couldn't see them in a theater for... anyway, it was. I remember it was that period when they came out again. Just happens to be at that time when you were graduating and becoming a shipping clerk in Florida. But you made your first film, which you were talking about.
Yeah, a 16mm film called A Road in Florida that I did in 83, and then I graduated in 84.
Okay. Oh, and that also doubled as your thesis project.
Yeah, I did a photography thesis as well. I was a studio, at the time, it was a studio art major because they didn't officially have the film major. So I was a studio art major with a concentration in film and photography, and I did a double thesis.
Mm-hmm. So after that, I assume you didn't stay in Florida terribly long.
No.
we appreciate that. No offense to Florida. It's just also maybe not the greatest place to pursue what you were probably starting to figure out was what you would like to pursue.
Yeah, I had no. It was a working situation for a semester, and then I came to New York and just had to make a go of it.
And it still very much, I would imagine, caught up in the punk and maybe the music coming out of that period.
Yeah, I was obsessed with it.
So a lot of visits to clubs, CBGBs or spots like that.
Yeah.
There were plenty of them at the time, weren't there?
Yeah, there were.
Not so much anymore, but at least those are not there anymore. There may be plenty of clubs, but
yeah.
The ones that were there at the time are kind of all pretty much gone at this stage.
Yeah, almost all. Webster Hall is still
operating.
It used to be the Ritz.
Right. Oh, right.
I think.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you started making, did you continue making experimental films?
I didn't consider them experimental, but
right.
If that's what other people wanted to call them, there wasn't too much I could do about it. I was just making films.
Understood. Yeah.
I'm still just making films. I don't know what they are. You know, it doesn't seem all that important to me to figure out what box they're supposed to fit in.
Gotcha. You know. That's fair enough. And I'm just, where do you get most of your, this is kind of a two part question, I guess. Where did you get, it sounds like music was an early influence, and I know you ended up collaborating with a number of musicians and bands, and which we'd also classify, you know, if one had to reduce to bands with more of an artsy side to them.
I wish I had been that open-minded back in those times.
Maybe they were just more when I was in high school. Commercial bands coming out of that period.
When I was in high school, I was listening to the Ramones. You know, I mean, I was as excited by the Ramones as any other music, and then you know, I went to high school with Ian MacKaye to public school in D.C. And while I was in high school, you know, he formed Teen Idols, and then eventually, when I went to college, he was in Minor Threat, and then Fugazi. So I was intimately aligned with some of those musicians. But again, I don't think that any of us were really concerned about genre. You know, we were just...
Yeah, sure. Well, this is a commercial thing that's imposed anyway, I suppose, right?
Yeah, so, it's inevitable. So, it's not the end of the world.
No.
But anyway...
Yeah. So anyway, you weren't obviously going into it either as a video, you know, quote unquote, video, rock video, music video director. You were coming from a different perspective also. They were more, for as far as you were concerned, collaborations. It wasn't like you were going to get some, this was, the idea wasn't to get a video onto MTV, which was in its birth too, actually, at the point, which maybe you could have, because they were probably hungry for this type of content, but...
MTV seemed to be an interesting possibility for about 5 minutes, and then it became very corrupt very quickly, and it basically became a form of industry advertising in which I had very little interest. There was a brief window where they were so hungry to fill up their hours that they would show sort of odd and interesting things on occasion, but it was also... It became, you know, pretty repulsive, pretty, like, extremely sexist and extremely slick and commercialized, and I didn't want to do that. But I did make about a dozen of them, generally in situations where I had a great deal of control and I could kind of go off and make a short film, and if someone wanted to call it a music video, that was
again fine with you.
Well, it wasn't really fine with me, but it meant that I could get paid, and that was a way of sustaining myself. So I ended up, you know, working for REM very early on, and that was really helpful and quite interesting for a while. So I did about a dozen, a couple of them were, but mostly I worked with, you know, Fugazi, who had no interest whatsoever in making a music video proper, and we got into other territory combining what they did and what I did, but we were thinking of it, if anything, as a kind of anti-music video approach.
And this was instrument?
No, this first was a piece called Glue Man.
Okay.
It was a song that I was involved in and actually writing some of the lyrics. And they did, you know, they were inspired to write the song because they came and I visit me in New York, and I had some Super 8 footage that I showed them, just projected it on the wall, and we ended up kind of going back and forth, and the song came out of a sort of shared experience. And then I did a film, and that song was on their first record, and that sort of established a working relationship that ended up continuing for quite a long time with the 10-year arc of making Instrument. So I was working, you know, I was very involved in music and working with bands, but they were generally very collaborative, independent projects in which either there was no label involved, no commercial label or major label, or even if there was a label, it was an unusual circumstance where I was given a lot of freedom. And when that, you know, became less and less possible, I got more and more out.
Out is pushed out, or
well, I stepped out. I just didn't want to be a music video director, mm-hmm. and I didn't like being referred to as one, because it was, I just, you know, most of MTV was a drag.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hear that. Fugazi was based again where? They were
very much a DC band.
Yeah, they
always
were. Okay. Yeah. Did you know those guys before? Just from when you were in high school, and that
I went to high school with Ian MacKay.
Did say that. Okay.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. The other guys I got to know from the moment that they were forming that band.
Mm-hmm. What was that?
I guess I knew Brendan too a little bit, but yeah, it was great. You know, to witness the beginnings of that and see them learning and mm-hmm. changing and navigating.
And something clicking with people and seeing that happen, that connection that they had with their audiences, and I assume. And
yeah, but it was also, it was just a very different template. I mean, Fugazi toured without regard to whether they were trying to push a record at the time.
It wasn't the vehicle that it was performing, and it was growing as a band. Artistically, it wasn't about selling records.
Yeah. And again, as I said before, you know, that all impressed me as a kind of template, that you just made stuff to make it and you tried to push yourself in order to push yourself, but it wasn't towards some goal of a career or getting into some film festival or selling your work to television. It's just what people did.
And I assume that, you know, you were also exposed to more and more European filmmakers and, you know, different types of film through this period as well. That became more available and...
Yeah, well, I had seen a lot of great cinema in college through the film series in particular. And so I was certainly...
Were you curating that?
I worked for the film series, so I had a hand in being able to request certain films, and you know, I remember seeing an amazing Hungarian film called Time Stands Still, and I remember, but I also, you know, I loved Raging Bull, you know, I mean, I loved a lot of things. I wasn't mm-hmm. making a distinction like, oh, I'm interested in European art films and therefore not in this. I didn't feel that way at all. And
I guess I was more just trying to draw a connection between your feelings about your career and what was probably more prevalent in Europe than here in the States, where Scorsese, for instance, made a handful of films and kind of quickly became a major Hollywood or major studio filmmaker, as opposed to, and, you know, is making much more commercial things with big Hollywood names at this stage, you know, but not criticizing. It's just that there seems to be very few filmmakers and artists in the States that can pursue a non-commercially driven career. Whereas in Europe, it feels as though, and I could be wrong, but it feels as though, and it's a very big continent with lots of countries and cultures within, so it's a generalization to say that you could have a career like a Chris Marker, who never made a commercial film in his life.
That's very true. I think that it's fair to say that Europe had a somewhat more supportive tendency towards the arts in general, and they're less embarrassed about it. Whereas in America, it's always been, you know, we kind of push our poetry and our experimental stuff to the margins. But, you know, we still had Cassavetes, and he was an enormous power to me. You know, I mean, I felt like the power of Cassavetes was, in its way, in a, you know, a homegrown American thing. I didn't think of it as like a European thing. Mm-hmm. So, but I also, you know, I got work in the film business in order to support myself. And I was kind of seeing both ends of the spectrum. I was going to Anthology Film Archives and Collective for Living Cinema, and seeing at that point, starting to see very personal and experimental and avant-garde work and more and more documentary work. But it also, I wasn't thinking about a career. I was thinking of making a movie and then making another movie. And then I had an idea for another movie, and it never really occurred to me to think about it in terms of like a career.
Right. Okay. But also you had people, you were trying to get people to see the films. No?
I mean, that was always kind of secondary, or, uh-huh, you know, beyond secondary. Sure. I wanted people to see the work, but,
well, how did you throughout the late 80s into through the 90s, how were you doing that? Were you working within a community? Was there a community of artists and filmmakers that you circulated within and that were kind of helped, it created a kind of a distribution in a way, or exhibition for what you were doing?
To be really honest, mm-hmm, I didn't really feel that I was part of a community very much. I felt there was a community, and I'm very thankful that they existed, but it tended to be a much harder dichotomy between experimental or so-called avant-garde work and other, or, you know, and I wasn't really comfortable with that, and they weren't really that comfortable or welcoming with my work early on. There were certain entities that were. There were a few film festivals. I eventually connected with the Video Data Bank in Chicago, and that was a way of distributing work, mostly to universities and media centers and little museums and things, mm-hmm, certainly not to movie theaters. And I just did my thing. It was very independent, and I was mostly working as a kind of one-man band and making the movies, shooting them, editing them, putting together the soundtracks. For a while, it didn't have a lot to do with a scene, or, you know, there was like a Lower East Side thing that people talked about, Cinema of Transgression. I had absolutely nothing to do with that. Mm-hmm. It seemed, you know, mm-hmm, like kind of dumb, you know, but there were places to go see interesting work here. And I would go to Anthology and watch Russian silent films, and go up to, you know, Lincoln Center when they had a Cassavetes retrospective, and so I was kind of soaking things in. But mostly I was walking around shooting, and a lot of that came out of a street photography tradition that I was very familiar with, that had little to do with, you know, what we're taught about filmmaking, even though it's very crucial to filmmaking. So people like, you know, Walker Evans and Atche, and then eventually, you know, Helen Levitt and Robert Frank, and those people were immensely important to me.
Ed, did you ever get to, meet any of these,
Yeah, I know, Robert Frank a little bit, and I've been very thankful to have made his acquaintance, and I'm closer to his wife, June Leaf, who's one of my favorite artists, very important to me. Mm-hmm.
What inspired Museum Hours? When did you start on that project?
Well, Museum Hours was inspired by the life I'd lived up until I made it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really was, because as I mentioned, I was taken to a lot of museums when I was a kid, which, mm-hmm, I didn't always appreciate, but it's sunk in. And I had a very fine art history teacher at Wesleyan, and that was a very important to me, looking at paintings and looking at art from the all the way from the deep past through, you know, people like Robert Smithson, who mm-hmm. kind of blew my mind. And so all of these things were influences, but Museum Hours, it mostly just came out of my own experience of being in this particular museum and looking at particular paintings by Peter Bruegel the Elder and feeling a kind of kinship. And a lot of it had to do with documentary as an idea, as an experience. And so I felt like I wanted to somehow take that on in a film. And I got the idea to use a museum guard as a kind of way to get at certain ideas, because it was a very down-to-earth character, a very down-to-earth situation that I could use in order to explore some wider territory.
Mm-hmm.
So it just came very naturally to me, except that, you know, the scale had to be a little bigger than I usually work in.
As far as making a fiction narrative?
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to do dialogue, then being a one-man band isn't necessarily such a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
It's nice to have a good sound man. It's nice to have,
yeah,
you know, somebody else to share the cinematography with, so that I could, I worked with a co-DP, and because I felt like if I wanted to put my camera down and just focus on the actors, I had that option. But I ended up shooting a lot of the film because I love to shoot.
And you had very good actors who
people, yeah, one of whom was not an actor at all, mm-hmm. non-actor. They were
the
great.
The guard is, what was the character's name again?
Bobby Summer played Johan, the museum guard, and mm-hmm. he was not an actor.
Right. It's an amazing performance to get out of a non-actor. You don't see that as too frequently.
Well,
I mean, I just saw, for instance, do you know David Gordon Green?
Mm-hmm.
I just had seen this film Joe with Nick Cage, but
yeah,
one of the characters is this actor who they found.
Yeah, wandering. I haven't. I'm looking forward to seeing that. I mean,
I'm not going to give away anything.
No. David told me about that guy. I mean, I hear he's amazing. Yeah, I mean, the thing is, let's face it, you're talking about the phenomena of it being kind of unusual to see a great non-actor, to get a great role from a non-actor. But that's not about, what you're talking about is the fact that people finance their movies because of the stars that they can pull into them. It has nothing to do with what's good for cinema or what's good in cinema, because many of the greatest performances I've ever seen were not only by non-actors, but they're more powerful because you're not distracted. Exactly. The distraction factor to me is absolutely immense. I mean, I can be watching a movie and sometimes I'm thinking, you know, oh, Sean Penn's doing a great job, but I'm thinking about Sean Penn doing a great job, mm-hmm. and I'm thinking about his other roles, and I'm thinking about, you know, what he had to do to prepare, and all of that takes me out of mm-hmm. the moment. It mm-hmm. takes me out of the movie.
Absolutely. I mean, when you're watching 12 Years a Slave, and all of a sudden Brad Pitt shows up in the role, you're thrown out of it.
Yeah, I felt the same way with, you know, Thin Red Line, which I liked a great deal, but it mm-hmm. pained me to think that, you know, mm-hmm. at the time he probably had to finance the film by packing it with...
Right. Also, if somebody like with a lot of money like Brad Pitt, who was also a Rainmaker, signs on as EP, you're going to give him a role. You know?
Sure.
But actually, you know, it's funny because I wasn't really even thinking about that with your films, but it's ironic that a lot of people go for that very reason to a movie, to see their favorite, to see the Sean Penn. They're not going because,
you know,
they're going to see a guard talk about,
right,
describe art to a, you know, a child or something.
That's understandable, and it can be wonderful. I mean, I'll go to a movie to see Humphrey Bogart. You know, I don't go to a movie to see Tom Hanks, but I you know, I love to see Marlena Dietrich, you know, that's okay. There's a place for all of this, but there's nothing like the feeling of seeing an early Kiarostami film in which you really have no idea whether people are even performing per se. Right. Sometimes, true. You know, and then it's can become very interesting to find out that indeed they were. But nonetheless, it's really a crying shame that that celebrity drives cinema to the degree that it does. And I think movies suffer for it, except in the rare occasion where they don't, where their performance is so special. You know, I go on like this, but then the other day I was, you know, sitting in a hotel room and one of the Godfather movies came on, and you know, it's extraordinary, and I didn't mind that it's
Marlon Brando.
Well, it wasn't. Yeah, you know, I was thinking of some of the smaller character actors in the movie who are really, really amazing. But you know, I'm still aware that they're actors. And so I'm not, it's not a one or the other proposition. There just ought to be a lot more room for doing what's really right for your movie. And for Museum Hours, I would have destroyed my movie if I had put known actors in it. I mean, Mary Margaret O'Hara has done some acting and she's an extraordinary singer, and some people knew her in advance as a performer. And in the case of the film Chain, you know, Miho Nakaido had done some acting before. She's been in, you know, Hal Hartley's films, but Mira Bilotti had not been an actor before. And so, but in both cases, they weren't so well known that the celebrity factor would be a distraction and from the film. And so,
of course, yeah.
Anyway, I feel like I'm giving you a lot of ramble for your buck.
Oh, no. Because, first of all, the people that are going to listen to an extensive conversation with someone, you know, they're sort of interested in...
They like the ramble. All right.
Yeah, the ramble is the very thing they're looking for.
All right. Well, let me know if they're interested a little too...
Of course. Museum Hours, we were saying. Museum Hours is had some success in the festivals, in the festival circuit a couple of summers ago. Years ago, it ended up at BAM Cinema Fest.
Yeah, I mean, it
that's
actually,
where I saw it.
It premiered at Locarno in 2012 in the summer. Then the North American premiere was Toronto. Uh-huh. And
so that was in the, Toronto's in September, October of 2012. So then it came to BAM last year, then, 2013.
Yeah, I think so. Okay. And the theatrical opening was in the spring of 2013. And is that right?
That doesn't make sense to me. Well, if it couldn't have been BAM Cinema Fest last summer. Cause
well, it played there. Let's just say it was there. I don't know. They happened around the same time.
Okay.
So suffice to say, yes, to everybody's amazement, the film not only had a nice festival life, but it actually did really well in theaters.
Hmm. Yeah, and it got some great reviews, I remember. How does that feel to you, though? Is it almost rub against?
No.
No, I'm sure it's satisfying. But
it doesn't. It's fabulous.
You're a sellout, finally.
No, it's great. I didn't do anything. I didn't change anything to make that happen. And I just happened to have distributors, Cinema Guild, who took it on fearlessly without any sense of diminished expectation, or, you know, they didn't go into it saying like, oh yeah, this is one of those weird, hard to pin down art films without known actors, so therefore let's just assume that no one's going to see it. They went in saying, oh, we love this movie, we think it really connects to people, let's do it, let's go for it. They did, and I'm very thankful. I'm thankful that they took it on with that attitude, but I'm also thankful that there are some distributors who actually only take on movies that they love and feel strongly about, and some of those movies are, in theory, impossible.
Marketing. Wise.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would think that Cinema Guild does do that. They found their niche, and that's why it's like Dan Salit, his latest film was, I think, picked up Terrence Nance His film was picked up by the Cinema Guild, I believe.
Right. Well, they did. They also did Leviathan and Monocomina and you know, Bellatar films. But I don't think they just find a niche. I think that they make a niche.
Okay.
Because people go to a movie and they're like, wow, I've never seen anything like this before. I'm going to keep an eye out for what they bring out next, because people are actually sometimes surprisingly hungry for things that they haven't seen before, and that might in some way open their mind or blow their mind or freak them out. And the more that we assume that that isn't the case, the more it's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Right, sure.
And so we are in a time where there's this extraordinary weight of blockbusters and stars and everybody getting all freaked out every goddamn time about the Academy Awards or Sundance or whatever. And it's just important to be reminded that there's a whole other universe where people just make interesting, unusual things. And I see them all the time at film festivals in particular.
Well, certainly at ones like Locarno.
Or the Viennale, you know, which is really kind of my favorite. And they were very supportive to me over the years. So, you know, this stuff happens. It's just important to recognize it so that it continues to happen.
Another sign of this is Vandor is curating films like we're talking about. They have museum hours and instrument on their site. So obviously people are interested in subscribing. So they may see it in this way, but I don't know how somebody from, you know, who lives in outside Indianapolis would see it otherwise.
Well, I mean, for one thing, Cinema Guild actually got it into the little theaters in the middle of nowhere. I mean, it played in, like, you know, Wilton, New Hampshire, which, like, blew my mind, you know. And so,
did you go to Wilton?
I didn't go. My elderly parents are not well, so I'm traveling very little, and I didn't go to most of the festivals that the film played in. But it did, you know, it popped up in a lot of very unusual places, and sometimes it actually... it did just fine. And as I said before, it's not because I changed my filmmaking make something more accessible or commercial or anything like that. I didn't at all, really. But I also think that the movie is pretty down to earth and it's kind of funny sometimes. And, you know, people, it doesn't necessarily feel like I didn't want to make a pretentious art film, but I've never wanted to make pretentious art films. Most of the work that I do is pretty straight up. It's just not necessarily that easy to identify like what the films are, and that throws some people off, but it also intrigues some people. And I'm not inventing something new or It's a tradition. It's a path that goes back to very early cinema for people to do personal films and cross-genre films and, you know, films where they're discovering what they need to make by making it. That's what Sigur Vertov did, and that's what, you know, Joris Evens did, and I think it's what Kiarostami did. It's Agnes Varda. You know, there's plenty of people, Chantal Ackerman, who just did their thing. I don't think any of those people were trying to fit in or declare that they were the first. I just think that that's what they're here for.
Doing a job.
Yeah.
Well, Sundance Now is doing a month-long retrospective of Chris Marker work, which is not always easy to find.
Right.
And they're also including a few films that are about Chris Marker or by other filmmakers who are ostensibly influenced.
So yeah.
The film, which will be nice for people, will potentially discover Museum Hours.
Yeah, I mean, I...
Through this Sundance Now website.
Yeah, I mean, Chris Marker, I don't even know where to start about Chris Marker because he is such a wonderful presence in the history of cinema, but also in the history of the hybrid, of the essay film, of basically crossing back and forth between boundaries and countries and time zones without a great deal of deference to commercial viability or popularity. And, you know, he's seen as this very kind of mysterious proposition, but he was actually very generous to other filmmakers. He was very kind to me. He was very kind to other filmmakers that I've known, many of whom are kind of working off the beaten path. And he also, you know, maintained a remarkable political engagement that was very complicated, but very passionate. And I'm thankful. It was great to have him in the world, and now it's great to have him in the world in his work. So I dedicated my earlier film Chain directly to Chris Marker and another filmmaker, Humphrey Jennings. Museum Hours has a kind of hidden dedication. I didn't feel like I needed to do it that twice in, you know, subsequent feature films, but there's a little initial at the end of the thanks, KMS, which is Krasnasandor, the name that mm-hmm. he used as the sort of cameraman character in Saint-Soleil and in other parts of his career. So it's Marker was so important to me that I'm happy to tip my hat to him many times. And I've been, you know, working on a series of shorts that are somewhat in homage to him. Maybe they'll even fall together in a longer form thing. I don't know. But, you know, here's to Chris Marker wherever he may roam.
It was an opportunity for me to watch. I don't remember the last time I saw Saint-Soleil, but I watched it again the other day.
Yeah, I mean, you can watch it any number of times. If there ever was a cliche that's true, in this case, I don't think that Saint-Soleil, you know, ever becomes redundant because it's very, very complex and very rich. And everybody who sees it will have their own experience, which is not something that you can say about a lot of films that are made. A lot of films are basically the ideas that everybody should have a pretty similar experience.
Mm-hmm. Which can be connective and okay, I guess, but it's nice to have the contrast.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's connective and okay until it's limiting and insulting to the intelligence of the viewer,
sure.
You know,
yeah.
Which is often the case in some of the most popular movies.
And that's how you, I suppose, figure out how to get it to the most people's, in front of most people's eyes, is to, you know, dumb it down to the, and I should say that, but to make it the most accessible
Why shouldn't you say that?
Because there are a lot of people that are smart that do look forward to tuning out when it comes to certain types of media. I don't, you know, what can I? I don't know. It's like the people maybe that you hear or find that they like to be challenged artistically or just stimulated in that way. And when it comes to going to the movies, they're looking for Tom Hanks, you know, and.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that those things necessarily have to be, again, so separable. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, I love to see a Marx Brothers movie.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be fantastic to be in a theater and there's a whole bunch of people laughing at a Marx Brothers movie.
Mm-hmm.
But really, the Marx Brothers movie is anarchy, and it's full of surprise and insanity. And if you were to take some of the jokes in a Marx Brothers movie and throw them at a focus group, some people would just be befuddled, or they'd say, like, well, that's too weird, or,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, it's not. So why think of, like, a popular comedy, like, for example, a Marx Brothers or a Charlie Chaplin or a Buster Keaton, and think of it in terms that those movies have nothing to do with being dumbed down. And they also have nothing to do with a focus group mentality, which tells their filmmakers, you have to end your movie this way because that's the only way it's going to sell. You know, we have to make room for every kind of movie, including movies that I don't necessarily, you know, care for, but I can still, they can still be a lot freer than movies often are. And I just think it's interesting that you were like using these words, you know, you were mm-hmm. saying like dumbed down, or you were saying, mm-hmm. you know, that people want to go and tune out.
Escapism, you know, obviously that's.
I'm totally.
One can have escapes, right. I know.
When I go see Chris Mark or San Soleil, I'm escaping all mm-hmm. over the place. Mm-hmm. I'm escaping.
But try having a conversation about it at the, you know, the typical conversation. Going back to when I said it's something people like some commercial stuff sometimes, because it does kind of, you know, we do experience it together, which is not requiring much from us. We just sort of sit and have, you know, this stimulation coming to us. And then we can kind of laugh at the certain moments which we're told or the kind of indicated that are these moments. But we do, there is something that's shared through there on some level, is all I was saying. And but you're right. I think when it comes to a Marx Brothers or Charlie Chaplin film, for instance, you can certainly just enjoy it on the surface level and still kind of be elevated somehow. Which you don't necessarily get a lot from some of the Avenger sequels.
Yeah, I miss those, so I wouldn't know. I mean, every once in a while there's a surprise there too. But mm-hmm. the fact of the matter is, it's just that it's up to us not to let one thing be the only thing and be so dominant that the other stuff doesn't even have a shot.
Mm-hmm.
And
absolutely.
By all rights, yeah. people could have looked at Museum Hours, and some of them did, you know, and they just immediately write it off.
Dismiss it.
And assume that, you know, mm-hmm. well, people aren't going to go for this. But the fact is, people out there, you know, in New Hampshire or the middle of the Midwest or other places where there aren't necessarily a lot of quote unquote art films, apparently there was something that they were hungry for in that film. And, you know, I've seen it many times that people think that they understand this industry, they think they know, and then you have, like, you know, Kelly Reichardt makes Old Joy, and, you know, I mean, mm-hmm. why would that movie do okay? Because it's an interesting, beautifully shot film. Mm-hmm. That's why. You know, let the people
Make up their own minds.
But they can only make their own minds up if they can access the films. And if people
see it in the first place, yeah.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, this my filmmaker friend, Orner Tikal, who I'm sure you've met.
I don't know.
Okay, anyway. But he sort of said, I did a live podcast thing not long ago, and he was like remarking on that Manola Dargis article about there's too many
right.
kind of mediocre independent films and they shouldn't be distributed, and there's too much of a flood of film. And it's interesting, A, that we're looking at those films as being the problem, right. where as opposed to, you know, if you're opening a film like, you know, and again, this is just arbitrary, but if you're opening up Spider-Man 2 at 4,000 screens, give up 5,000 of those. I'm sorry, 500 of the screens. Maybe 5,000 of them. But give up 500 of those screens and put in Old Joys of the World and Museum Hours of the World and see how these films do. They don't have a shot.
You know? But the other thing is that...
So again, we're glad for Sundance Now and Fandor in the meantime. But,
yeah, you know. But the other thing is that it could also have happened that Museum Hours would come out and very few people would see it. All right? The question then to me is, of those few people, you know, maybe some of them were really deeply affected. So it's nice to me that the movie found some success and sort of surprising degree of it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not really that's not really what it's about either. It's about something, you know, you were talking about Chris Marker movies and that they were difficult to see. Yeah, that's true. But, you know, when people did see them and when people sought them out, they had their minds blown. Sometimes they had their lives changed, or they were a universe of possibility was opened up to them in a way that it seldom is with a film. And Marker put all of his energy into making the next thing and very, very, very little energy into selling the previous thing. And that's okay too.
Well, right, because then you're as a film, as a, you're no longer a filmmaker, you're now a distributor working on getting people into seats and not making films.
Exactly. And that is the expectation now. Now everybody is saying, particularly in the independent quote unquote community, mm-hmm. that this is a given, that we are all going to have to be publicists and distributors, and we're going to have to learn how to do our little elevator spiel in one line and you know, all of that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's actually, to some degree, there's some truth in that. There's some sad truth in it, because we live in a country that simply doesn't support the arts. So sometimes we simply have to,
pick up the slack because you don't have the budget for hiring a publicist.
But it's also, all filmmakers are not meant to be publicists, and mm-hmm. some of them are better filmmakers because they're not good publicists.
Mm-hmm.
And people are losing sight of that as an equation because they're putting too much attention on the publicist side.
Mm-hmm.
Not that there's anything wrong with publicists. We had a good one for Museum Hours, and I'm very thankful that we did. But, you know, that's not what every filmmaker needs to be. So I think it's very important that people start reckoning with that a little bit more in this pressure that filmmakers feel now, especially in the independent world. A lot of that is not going to result in better films. It's just going to be resulting in more things getting in your face.
And these longer periods between films or projects.
Sure.
Because you have to travel with the film and peer and...
Yeah, I mean, I'm not... Yeah. That's important. I'm not against traveling with the film. I'm really thankful that there, you know, at least is some kind of circuit that encourages that, because it's great to
meet the people
and have... Talk with them. See what they think you made and all of that. That can be quite wonderful. But there's a difference between that and catering your work towards maximum publicity.
And sort of hitching your filmmaking career onto this huge machine, which is all about growing. Then the expectations are the budget's going to grow in the next film. You're going to start adding better known faces and names to it in order to get more people to come to it. Then the next thing you know, and this is what many wonderful filmmakers are swept up in this, that this is how you grow as a filmmaker. And it's probably true that if they do make those decisions, then they will be able to focus more on filmmaking. But, you know, is it still their films that they're going to be making once they're caught into this
Exactly.
You know, exactly. Momentum. That's, Well, this was a great conversation, but I've taken up twice as much of your time as I think you had intended. We'll pick this up hopefully maybe again sometime.
Sure.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks for letting me talk.
Thank you for talking. Hope you enjoyed the conversation with Jem Cohen, and if you do get a chance again, you can check out Jem's film Museum Hours if you haven't seen it yet. Again, you can watch it, on, of course, on Fandor. So consider subscribing to this great website, and as I mentioned, they are also streaming his earlier film, Instrument. And we'll be back in a couple of weeks with another Fandor-sponsored episode with filmmaker Joe Swanberg. So get all these shows and more by subscribing to FilmWax Radio on iTunes or however you subscribe through your smartphone app for podcasts. Okay, guys? I guess that's going to be it. I'm going to kind of cut out of here. In the meantime, thank you for listening to FilmWax Radio presented by Rooftop Films. We'll be back in a few days with episode number 211. Thank you for listening.